Oh, that's right. The two random lines.
So we're gonna jump back a little bit, but yes, we are at the end of Perek Kafei. Last week we spent some time talking about Abigail and the conversation between Abigail and David, and the phrase "v'zachatat amatecha," what she means when she says at the end "v'zachatat amatecha." We looked at various possibilities. Was she in fact alluding or hinting to David that maybe she would be willing to marry David at some point in the future? Or we kind of shied away from that interpretation, although that's certainly one that appears in the Gemara. We felt it a little bit too critical of Abigail, and looked at it more in terms of her final statement to David, which is to assess what she's saying and to judge it on its own merits. David sees in her the kind of chesed and the kind of wisdom that allows everybody to save face, and in the meantime, she goes back to Naval, and that's sort of where we left off. Pasuk Lamed Vav, Vatavo Abigail el Naval, V'hine lo mishte beveto, ki mishte amelech, v'lev Naval tov alav, v'hu shikor ad ma'od. Naval was in the middle of a feast. He was glad of heart, glad of spirit. He was enjoying himself with a lot of wine. And because there's a lot of wine, she decides, she decides, under the influence of alcohol, is not the time to share with him the news that she went behind his back, undermined his authority, shared their wealth with David, and appeased David in order to avoid the bloodbath that would have ensued. And recognizing that Naval was not going to take to all of that kindly, she decided that that's not the time. And further evidence to her insight and wisdom, as she is described at the beginning of the story, as Isha Tovat Sechel Fifat Toar. Vayi baboker betzet hayayin min Naval. In the morning, he sobered up. The wine left him, he sobered up. So she told him exactly what happened. His heart died in his chest and became like a stone. And 10 days later, he died. So it's a fascinating phrase. I think we talked about this a little bit last week. A very powerful phrase, that kind of almost a graphic depiction of the process of a heart attack, where the heart hardens or has an event, and then he dies. Vayishma David ki met Naval, vayomer Baruch Hashem asher rav et rivi et riv cherpati miyad Naval ve'et avdo chasach mera'a ve'et ra'at Naval heshiv Hashem b'rosho. Makes a bracha. He thanks God for, in a sense, for fighting his battles, for fighting, defending his shame, fighting his enemies, but doing so in such a way that he himself did not have to involve himself, prevented his servant from having to do anything negative, and visits the evil upon his enemies. Veishlach David, and then, after a period of time, Veishlach David vaydeber b'Avigail l'kachta lo l'isha. After a period of time, he, whatever the appropriate time is, David sends a messenger with the tidings that he would be willing to take Abigail as his wife. Vayvo avde David al Abigail Carmela, vaydabru elea lemor, David shlachanu elayich lekachtech lo leisha. Yeah, that's going to be, So, the messengers come and they speak in the name of David. David, our master, has sent us to you to take you as a wife. Takom hatishtach lapayim arza vatomer. She bows down to the ground. Vatomer, she says, Hinea matcha l'shivcha l'rchotz l'aglei avdei Adoni. Your servant is not worthy to wash the feet of my master. Vatamaher, Vatakuma Vigayo, Vatirkav Alachamor. She goes, she rides on the donkey, Vachamesh Narotea, Al Chotleragla, Vatelech, Acharei Malachei David, Vatihila Leisha. She goes after the messengers of David, and she agrees to be his wife. So, in the moment, and we spoke a little bit about spoke a good deal about the marriage of David and Avigail, I think we spoke about last week a little bit, correct? We touch on that? No? Clearly, he sees, what does David see in Avigail? Why does he make this overture to her to be his wife? I think the characteristics that he sees in her are self-evident, namely certainly wisdom, insight,
beauty.
Although at no point does he ever say that he found her beautiful or attractive. We are told at the beginning of the parak, the narrator tells us that she is both wise and beautiful. That is never part of the conversation between David and Avigail. So from a text perspective, that's not, it's interesting, it's just not there.
The narrator is the Navi, right?
Correct, but that's just a factual statement, but it's not a dynamic. For example, in Yaakov and Rachel, Yaakov sees that she's very beautiful, and it's part of the dynamic. By Avram and Sarah, it's part of the dynamic of the relationship between them. It's never part of the dynamic of the relationship between David and Avigail, at least not doesn't say so. It's just in the description of Naval and Avigail at the beginning of the story, we are told that she is beautiful, although we are told that she is wise before we're told that she is beautiful, and that's unique in this role. She's described as Tovat Sechel, Fatmara. And so that's a separate issue. But certainly in terms of the dynamic with David, that's never part of the, in the perek, in the text, it's not part of the conversation. What does seem to be part of the conversation or is number one, her insight. He blesses her several times. Baruch tamech ubucha'at ashekilitini ayom azeh mibob adamim. Blesses her that it was her wisdom, her insight that enabled him and her action that enabled them to avoid terrible calamity. And so he sees in her the kind of balat chesed that she is. And that would fit in line with what David and Melech would see as the classic Eshet Chayil, given the fact that the paradigm for him, for David is his great-grandmother, namely Ruth. And the parallel between Avigail and Ruth, we spent some time talking about in the previous class. So a good deal of parallel. There's the Ruth theme that plays out here. David picks up on it, and he offers her to marry him. The other piece of this conversation, or the other piece that he acknowledges here, is a little bit of his responsibility. Right? In the end, after the death of Naval, he acknowledges that God punished Naval because of him. And if God punished Naval because of the way Naval treated him, in a sense, there's a certain amount of responsibility that he has in the overall, not necessarily legal responsibility, but certainly in a sort of a moral responsibility. It was in that regard. And that is a characteristic that is common, it's not the only place we see David behaving in that way. David's relationship with Bathsheba will take on a very dramatic part of this sense of responsibility, because in the aftermath of the story of Bathsheba, David keeps Bathsheba as his wife, despite the fact that he pays a very heavy price politically for it, because he has a moral responsibility to her once the story is over. Because the alternative, which is to throw her out, would basically doom her to a life of shame and a life of being, she'd never remarry. So part of his responsibility, part of his tshuva, is to bear that responsibility for Bathsheba for the rest of his life. Here it's not quite that dramatic, but he certainly sees a certain amount of responsibility for her because of what happened to Naval. He's not responsible for what happened to Naval. Naval is. But he was the catalyst.
He also said you owe me one.
Only, again, so it depends on how you look at that phrase, Zachata Tametecha, right? So we had taken that phrase in a different direction than the Mepharshim or Chazal. Uncomfortable with it as we were, we looked at it from a different perspective. But leave that aside, that might be what's going on as well. That now, but I just want to pick up on that sense of responsibility, right? That notion that David marries her, but carries with her a certain amount of responsibility that he has for the overall situation with Naval, I think plays a very interesting role in what happens in the continuation of the story. So we're going to leave for a moment the next two verses. It's a subject we'll come back to tonight, okay? Because they're really sort of the focal point. But I just want to pick up on a nuance of the story of Abigail that doesn't get enough attention. So David marries Abigail. We are then told in the next pasuk that Achinoam lakach David miYisrael vatiena gam shtehem lo lenashim. In addition to Abigail, he marries another woman. It's not clear when he marries her. I suspect a little bit later in time. It's not happening now, but nonetheless, he marries another woman by the name of Achinoam miYisrael, from Emek Yisrael, and they two together, they two, T-W-O-T-O-O. Vatiena gam shnehem. You see that? Vatiena gam shtehen. They two, two. They, T-W-O-T-O-O, were his wives. They, two, two, were his wives. Right? Gam shtehem. They, two, number, right? Also, right? So it's just an interesting phraseology, and when you put it into English, it becomes even more interesting.
That means there's another one, because Michal...
Oh, and so the pasuk will also tell us that what happened to Michal. We'll come back to what happened to Michal in a moment. And what the phrase comes to him is, we'll come back to it. But certainly he has two wives, namely Abigail and Achinoam HaYisraelit. The truth is he has other wives, because as he becomes king, part of being king was political alliances and political marriages. It was certainly part of the world of monarchy of ancient life. And so when we turn to Perek Tishmul Bet, turn to Shmuel Bet Perek Gimel.
Yud Aleph.
Shmuel Bet Perek Gimel, beginning of the Perek. Shmuel Bet starts where after the death of Shaul. Shaul dies at the end of Perek, end of Shmuel Aleph. It's sort of the dividing line between Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Bet, is the death of Shaul. And what ensues is a very lengthy war between David and his followers, who anoint David as king over the tribe of Judah, and Shaul's son Ishbosheth and the followers of the house of Shaul, namely Benjamin and the tribe of Benjamin and the tribe of Ephraim and the other tribes in the north. And what ensues is a lengthy civil war, which is described in the first two or three chapters of Shmuel Bet. ותהיה מלחמה ארוכה בין בית שאול ובין בית דוד, ודוד הולך וחזק, ובית שאול הולכים ודלים. David's, beginning of Shmuel Bet Perek Gimel. David's house was growing, the house of Shaul was waning, meaning the house of Shaul was weakening in this battle, the house of Shaul was gaining strength, and there's sort of a tide is tables have been turned, and eventually this is going to lead to a surrender of the forces of the house of Shaul and the appointment of David over as king over all of Israel. In the meantime, David sets up a kingdom. He sets up a palace. He sets up a capital. That capital is in the city of Hebron, because he's not right there in the middle of a civil war. He's only king over Yehuda at this point. So his capital is in Hebron. So, as was common at that time, we need to have a review of the kingdom. So the Navi goes here, lists the kind of a picture overview of the house of David, at least as it was in Hebron, before the kingdom was united. And we have a list of David's sons. Vayivaldu leDavid banim beChevron. David has children in Hebron. Vayi bechoro Amnon la'achinoam ha'Yisraelit. His firstborn was Amnon, born to Achinoam ha'Yisraelit. Have we seen Achinoam ha'Yisraelit?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, she's the second wife that he marries at the end of chapter 25. Correct? Gam shtehem. Umishneu, his second. Ki la'av la'avigayel eshet navala karmeli. Ki la'av, son of Avigail, eshet navala karmeli. Vashlishi, the third, Avshalom ben Ma'acha, bat Talmai melech Geshur. Avshalom ben Ma'acha was the daughter of the king of Geshur, which is an area near the Bashan. V'harvi'i Adoniya ben Chagit, v'hachamishi Shvatya ben Avital, v'hashishi Yitzra'am le'agla eshet David, ela yuldu le'David be'chevron. So we have a list of the sons born to David in Hebron before he became king over all of Israel. It's a fascinating list. Some of these wives we're familiar with. Each one is a different wife. That's why you have, basically it lists the firstborn, it lists the children of each from each wife, the main households, if you will. I'm sure he has more children than that. But these are the first ones of each. Each one has a different mother. And what's fascinating is the you already see David behaving in a manner that is monarchy-ish, if you will, because the third one, Avshalom, is the son of Ma'acha bat Talmai Melech Geshur. So you already see the political alliance of that marriage. You follow?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The sons here, and I'm particularly interested in the first four. Latter two don't really play a big role except for Shvatya ben Avital. Shvatya ben Avital plays a very interesting historical role. Anybody know it? What it is? A millennia later, right? 400 years later is the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Then they go into the Babylonian exile. Then they come back. And then they have... half a millennia later. When the house of David is destroyed and the kingdom is ended and they go into exile, they almost lose the lineage of the house of David. Now, the lineage of the house of David for the throne was through Shlomo. After the Churban HaMikdash, that line ends. And the Gemara actually states that the line of David HaMelech that went from Shlomo reconnects in the beginning of Beit Sheni through Zerubbabel, and then after Zerubbabel is destroyed, right, essentially that line is lost, and so there's this potential to lose the entire house of David HaMelech, and if that happens, then so ends the dream of ever having Yemot HaMashiach, because without the line of David HaMelech, there's no Melech HaMashiach to restore to the throne of Israel. You follow what I'm suggesting? Right. So there is a tradition, and it's recorded in the Gemara, that the line of the house of David is rekindled or reestablished from a different son. Right. We lose the tradition of all of the sons of David in terms of the lineage, with the exception of one. And it's very important because in the time of the Gemara, the time of Beit Sheni, post Beit Sheni, the time of Chazal, when they lived in Bavel, it was that line that reestablished the dynasties of the exilarchs, the Reish Galuta in Bavel, who were scions and descendants of the house of David. It all stems through Hillel HaZaken. Because the Gemara says that Hillel HaZaken was a descendant, Mitzetzaei, Shvatya ben Avital Eshet David HaMelech. Now we don't have the lineage, but we have the tradition in the Gemara that Hillel HaZaken, who starts the dynasties of the heads of the Sanhedrin and the continuation of that line through the time of Chazal, right, is a descendant of Shvatya ben Avital. This Shvatya ben Avital right here. So you should just be aware that he plays a very important role much later in history. Coming back to our story, however, I'm very interested in the first four. Who are the first four? Amnon, the Bechor, mm-hmm. is Amnon. Now, they're all Bechors. Why are they all Bechors? All firstborns of their mother.
Mm-hmm.
But the Bechor here is referenced because it's when you talk about the heir to the throne, the crown prince isn't just the firstborn from his mother. Doesn't even have to be the crown prince from his... The firstborn from his father. the crown prince, by definition, at least in the world of Tanakh, is the firstborn of the primary wife of a king. Okay, so ultimately it becomes a function or a definition question of who's the primary wife, and that becomes much later a conversation between David and his various factions as to who he chooses to be his primary wife. He will choose Bathsheba, and Bathsheba's firstborn is Shlomo. So that will become an issue much later. But here, the Bechor is Amnon, Lachinoam Yisraelit. Next in line, Kilav Eshet Naval HaKarmeli. Next in line, Shlishi, Avshalom ben Maacha. Next in line, Arvi'i, Adoniah ben Chagit. So what's interesting about these four? Amnon, Kilav, Avshalom, and Adoniah. You ever play the Sesame Street game?
Mm-hmm. One of these things.
One of these things is not like the other? Avshalom. Sorry, Amnon, Kilav, Avshalom, Adoniah.
Doesn't start with an olive.
Okay, doesn't start with an olive. Fair. Amnon, Avshalom, and Adoniah. Okay, fair. The other one's Kilav. All right. If you start with an olive, one doesn't. I'll buy it. Anything else?
Well, one has, right, there's a Malchus.
What do we know about Amnon? Do you know anything about Amnon, Adoniah, and Avshalom?
Just their mothers.
Besides what's written here, do we, meaning in our study of Tanakh and knowledge of Tanakh, do we know anything about these three?
Avshalom was later on started a revolution.
Avshalom rebels,
right,
and to take over the kingdom, he rebels against his father, and there's a major war between David and Avshalom. Avshalom is one of the major rebellions against David. What motivates the rebellion of Avshalom? Do you remember? What motivates the rebellion of Avshalom is the tragedy of the story of Amnon and his sister Tamar. Familiar with the story? Not familiar with the story? Okay. Amnon is a tragic figure. Amnon eventually violates his sister, and Avshalom takes revenge, and he kills him. Adoniah is Amnon is part of that cabal. Amnon dies, Avshalom rebels against David, and then in the aftermath of that rebellion, Avshalom dies. And by the time that whole story is done, and David HaMelech himself puts Shlomo on his throne, and then David dies, Adoniah leads the rebellion, because he doesn't accept that that Shlomo is on his throne. So, of these four sons, Amnon dies in this violation of Tamar, Avshalom dies in his rebellion against David, and Adoniah dies in his rebellion against David. In other words, Amnon, Avshalom, and Adoniah, all three of them, at some point or another, vie for the throne. Amnon in a very strange way, but not our issue for today. All three of them are playing the power play for the throne. The only one who does not is Kilav ben Avigail, which is fascinating because technically I was not sure which came first. Did Achinoam, Israelite, come first, or did Avigail come first? It's not clear. Everyone's go both ways.
It depends on who he considers the primary wife.
Right. But Kilav never plays a role in the vie for the throne game that the children seem to play in the house of David. Mystery number one. Mystery number two is Avigail is the only one described as by the identity of her former husband.
Right.
Bat Avigail Eshet Naval HaKarmeli. Now it could just be so we should know which Avigail it is. Right. She was, who had been, the widow, meaning the wife of the now deceased Naval HaKarmeli. Possibly, but it's an odd way to describe the sons of David. Kilav, son of Avigail, wife of Naval HaKarmeli, Alav HaShalom. Just an odd phraseology. Right? And the third mystery of this son is his name. Kilav. What's Kilav? Why would that be an interesting name? What does it look like? What does it sound
Kalev.
Like?
It looks like Kalev.
Right. It looks like Kalev or Kalev. Correct? So how does that... Why is it relevant? How were we first introduced to Nevala Karmeli?
Yeah, like a dog.
No, I forget the dog piece of it. What was the Yuchas issue that we were introduced to Nevala Karmeli?
He was from the line.
It's fascinating to me that we remember the interpretations we reject, but we don't remember the interpretations we accept. Vahu Kalibi. Vahu Kalibi. Why is it Kalibi? Because he comes from the house of Kalev. And here, David marries the widow of his nemesis, Naval, names the child Kilav. Why? So there is a theory out there, and Chazal rejected. Chazal say it's the scoffers of the generation made this suggestion. I think that there's some basis to it. That Kilav is not David's son.
Oh, she's pregnant already.
Either that she was pregnant already, or what's more likely is that he was Naval's son.
Right, because she was pregnant when she...
He wasn't pregnant. Naval had a son.
Right.
She doesn't have to be pregnant. She has to have a son. Right? That when Naval died... Avigail had already had a child by the name of Kilav in the house of Kalev. Mm-hmm. And David adopts this child when he marries Avigail. There is such a theory.
Never in the running for king,
which is why he's never in the running for king.
And he named him a name that would always be a reminder of...
Well, David didn't name him.
Oh, right.
He's already born. He's already existing. He could be 15 years old for all we know, right?
It's still his name.
We have no idea. His name was from the house of Kalev, right? Kalibi. So it's a name that's part of the lineage of the house of Naval. So that's a possibility. The other possibility is a little more subtle, and that is that if he could in fact be David's son, but that David saw in his marriage to Avigail, a moral responsibility to continue the family line of Naval and Avigail, much like a act of Yibum, which would be another link between the story of Avigail and Ruth. And if that's the case, it would explain why David would name this child Kilav, and why also he wouldn't really be a vie for the throne, because it's really a continuation of the house of Naval that had been destroyed, and that David saw the moral responsibility to rebuild through the act of Yibum. So there's two possibilities. I throw them both out there. They both reflect the kind of... The marriage to Avigail is one of dignity. The marriage to Avigail is a positive picture, one of devotion, commitment, responsibility, morality to Avigail, and to the house that Avigail represents, which is the house of Naval, either by adopting the son that already exists, or by naming the child after the house of Naval as a kind of act of Yibum. Either way, you sense that sense of responsibility, that morality, that David reflects in his acceptance of Avigail. Okay. Yes? Good? Part one?
Okay.
Closure. Yes.
Part.
Yes.
Did we ever discuss Shaul's wife?
Nope.
So all of a sudden...
By David is relevant, because David has many, and his children play a big role, and David creates a dynasty. Shaul never creates a dynasty, so his sons are... Yonatan. I don't think we ever even know Yonatan's mother. I don't think so. Okay. So now let's come back to Perikaf Hei in Shmuel Aleph. And come back to these last two psukim that are so problematic. Let's do them one at a time. Pasuk Mem Gimel. Vet Achinoam lakach David mi Yisrael vatiena gam shtehen lo nenashim. Achinoam he also took as a wife, and they too also too. I don't even know how to do it. And they too. They both were also his wife. Gam shtehen lo lenashim. Atiyana gam shtehen lo lenashim. So, what's the oddity in this pasuk? Several oddities in this pasuk. Everybody see where I am? Perikaf Hei, pasuk Mem Gimel. 25, 43. of Shmuel Aleph. Back to the end of the parak. What's the oddity in this verse? Let me ask you the question chronologically. When does David marry Achinoam Yisraelit? Right after he marries Abigail. Right? Marries Abigail in Pasuk Mem Gimel, Mem Bet, Vatilu Leisha. Then he turns around and marries Achinoam. Et Achinoam lakach David Yisrael.
There could be time in between those two verses.
There could be, there should be, there would be, there might be. There has to be.
Could you translate Lakach as had married?
You could, in which case he had married Achinoam first, possibly, which would explain the listing of his wives in Shmuel Bet, mm-hmm. which places Achinoam first, mm-hmm. in which case we're told that he had already married Achinoam Israelit, and so Abigail is a second wife, which would explain also the sense of obligation he feels towards her, meaning that the marriage here isn't just because he needs a wife, he already has a wife, but because he feels a sense of responsibility for her, which is what we've suggested all along. Certainly possible. Also possible that it's after. Abigail is first. And then we're told that, oh, by the way, at some point in the future also, he's going to have a second wife by the name of Achinoam. And they're both going to be his wives. Gam shtehem l'nashim. Except that, you know, that's somewhat problematic, because then why is it relevant to our parak? Like, who cares? The story is about Abigail. It's not about Achinoam. You see my problem?
Yeah.
The story is about Abigail. Perek Chaf Hei is about Abigail. Why do I care about Achinoam at this point in time? We're not told about every marriage that David has and every wife that he has. We have children. In that perek that I read to you before, in Perek Gimel, we have lists of children and wives who we never saw before that verse, and we'll never see again. Huh. We're just told that they exist, right? They have a child. Avshalom, Ben, right? Whatever. We're not told when he married her, etc. We're not told the story of every marriage. We're told the ones that are relevant because they have a story to them. So, Abigail has a story. It's told. We're told that story. It's relevant. Achinoam has no story. Like, it's just the fact. So why is it here?
You're going to tell us.
I'm just throwing it out there. Because then, on top of it all, the pasuk says, Vatiena gam shtehen lo l'nashim. They were both also his wives.
Which is
an odd phrase.
Does lakach have to mean...
marriage? Yes.
Okay.
Yes. What else could it mean in Tanakh? But what is gam shtehem lo l'nashim? They both were also his wives. What do you mean they both were also his wives? And here the Mefarshim are struck by that phrase and divide into two different directions.
Does it imply that he has other wives?
Right. Is it an implication that they were two in addition or two instead of?
Instead of Michal?
Right. In other words, we keep forgetting that there is a wife.
Because he never really divorced her.
Well, that's going to be the question we're going to get to in a second. Right. There is a wife. Her name is Michal Bat Shaul, back in chapter 18. He left her because he had to run for his life. She saved his life by letting him leave out the window and out the back door of the palace and run for his life. And then she risked her life to save his by lying to her father. So he has a wife. Right? And look what happens next in Pasuk Mem Dalet. Now, Pasuk Mem Dalet is a fascinating Pasuk because it is in the chapter division, it's the last verse of chapter 25. Right. In the paragraph division, which is a Jewish tradition, a much more authentic Jewish tradition of how to divide Tanakh, It's the first verse of the next story. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
So, where do you put this is a fascinating question. But what it says is, V'sha'ul natan et Michal bito eshet David l'tfalti ben Laish asher migalim. Sha'ul had given Michal, his daughter, wife of David, away to another man by the name of Palti ben Laish from Galim, meaning that in the aftermath of David's flight, rebellion, treason, whatever you want to call it, Sha'ul had taken Michal and given her away to somebody else. Right. Well, we're going to come to the technicalities of it. Right. We're going to come to the technicalities of it, of how that operate in 1 second. But that verse is the linchpin, because if it's part of chapter 25, what it's saying is, and this is where the Mephoshim pick up, right? You have the Mephoshim split on this. If it's part of chapter 25, what it's saying is, Avigail and Achinoam were both his wives in addition to Michal, who, by the way, Shaul had taken and gave her away to somebody else. Or it's saying they were his wives. Now Gam Shtehem, these two were his wives in lieu of, or instead of, Michal, because Michal had been given away by Shaul to somebody else. In other words, either way, the Gam Shtehem phrase says he's got Achinoam, he's got Avigail, but he no longer has Michal. Now it's and one thing's clear: Shaul did not give Michal away in the aftermath of the story of Avigail. And Shaul's not watching David marry somebody else and then decides to give his daughter to somebody else. Right? Natan had given. The Mefarshim all agree that the marriage of Michal to Palti ben Laish is an earlier story.
Yeah.
It's just tagged on here. Because once we talk about the first marriage that David enters into post-Michal, then we digress. Avigail. Oh, and by the way, also there's Achinoam. We should just be aware of that. And those two, what happened to Michal? Well, Michal has... We'll come back to Michal eventually. But Michal, for now, has been given away to somebody else. So there's this listing of David's wives. It's kind of a postscript to the Perek that says, here's a listing of David's wives, Avigail, Achinoam, but not Michal. Because Michal, Shaul has given away. And that sort of leaves us with a bit of a tragic taste at the end of the Perek. Right here, the whole Perek was so beautiful and so altruistic and so positive towards Avigail and the morality of David and his sense of responsibility for Avigail. And then there's a pause and says, but wait a second. But Avigail's not his only wife, number one. Yeah, he's Achinoam, so he's got a second wife. And number two, more importantly, he no longer has Michal. Let's not forget Michal. And Michal's the real tragedy in the story.
Because also that was an opportunity to unify the two houses. Shaul and David, and that's gone out the window.
Correct. And because Michal made a choice.
Did she?
Yeah.
Sure she did.
Sure. What was the choice? The choice wasn't to be given away to Baal Tim and Laish. The choice was earlier than that. The choice was when David ran, did Michal run with him?
Right. She didn't.
Okay. She chose to remain behind.
Uh-huh. Like
Yonatan. She made the same choice Yonatan makes. Which is why it's fascinating, how is Michal described here? V'Shaul Natan et Michal Bito Eshet David. There's an ambivalence here, because remember back in chapter 18, she's constantly described as Michal Eshet David, but she is Bat Shaul. Right? That a description of Michal as either Bat Shaul or Eshet David plays a role depending on which chapter you're reading. Here it's both.
But it shows that she's still his wife then.
We'll come to that issue in a second, but certainly perceived as, or right, the same way that that Avigail is described as Eshet Naval after Naval died and David married her. Right? There's a certain perception to identify people's connections. Right? But we need to, but that's how she is described.
So the modern day movie, David would be, the ending would be different. Right?
Meaning?
David would be going back
and saving her from this.
Well, hold on, because David will come back, and David will come back and save her from Palti Ben Laish, but we haven't gotten there yet. That's in Perek Gimel of Shmuel Bet, where he will demand the return of his Michal. Yeah, that's a tragedy, also.
Stay tuned.
Yeah.
And they had no children together.
David and Michal have no children. That's also part of the tragedy. That's another story in Sefer Shmuel Bet. We'll come to that. Where David gets angry at her and rejects her and rebukes her, and the text says that they never had any children after that.
This,
what are you reading?
Has the correct definition, the correct definition for, you know, what we just read. But you know how you said you hate
correct?
Me? Yeah, because you said you dislike these.
Correct old. is subjective.
No, just I'm saying just the way that this older version completely ignores like the translation.
Ask these down.
Says, and Saul had given his daughter to Palti the son of Lach, who is from Galilee. Totally right. Ignores the.
Eshet David Akolev.
Eshet David, yeah, they totally ignore.
Right. Right. Okay.
It's mentioned in the bottom. Like in the notes, but in the digest, the commentary, but it's totally right. Ignored in the
translation.
Yes, excuse me. That's what I meant. Okay. Right. I think it's
so. Of course, it raises a very serious question. Okay, what's the question that it raises? The story of Palti Ben Laish raises a very serious question, which is, okay, she's married to
David.
How does the father simply take the wife of his son-in-law, meaning his daughter,
right.
Who's married to his son-in-law,
right.
And just give her to somebody else. Kind of just, boom, man, what happened to the first marriage? David ran away in the middle of the night. Okay, and just to make my life more interesting, let's go back to the parak that we started to read before, which is Shmuel Bet, Parak Gimel. And remember we said that the war, after Shaul's death, the war was tilting in favor of David. Correct?
Mm-hmm.
That's that moment where you have this description of David's sons and all of his wives.
Okay.
Beginning of Perek Gimel of Shmuel Bet. At that point, look at Pasuk. Well, you know, Aleph Avner comes to David and they make a pact between them. And David says to him, Vayishlach David, Pasuk Yedalad. Vayishlach David Malachim el Ishboshet ben Shaul lemor. David sends a messenger to Ishboshet. Ishboshet is the son of Shaul. Son ben Shaul saying, Tana et Ishti et Michal asher erasti li b'me'or lot plishtim. I want my wife back. Give me back my wife Michal, who I betrothed with. If you remember the very graphic story when he had to go and Shaul wanted to really have him killed, so Shaul set the price of the marriage to his
right.
daughter as the death of 100 Philistines. Oh, sorry, 30 Philistines. David went and killed 100 Philistines, and he took their foreskins, and he brought them as the Kesef Kedushin, right? The financial gift for which he would betroth Michal. Vayishlach Ishboshet vayikachea me'im ish me'im Palti ben Laish or Palti o ben Laish. So Ishboshet had no choice. So Ishboshet then took Michal, who is either his sister or his half sister, but Ishboshet is the king of the northern kingdom, and he separates her from Palti o ben Laish. Vayelech ita isha. Haloch uvacho acharea ad bachurim, Palti ben Laish escorted her. Her husband went with her, crying along the way, as far as bachurim. Vayomer elav Avner, to which Avner then said to Palti ben Laish, Lech shuv, you go home. Vayashov, he goes home, and Avner takes Michal and brings her back to David. What happens here is a tragedy, but it's a fascinating story. But clearly, there is a depth of an emotional connection between Palti ben Laish and Michal.
Well, at least right. from his point of view.
Right.
Do we ever get any information on Michal and what her...
No, because it wouldn't necessarily give it to us, because that's not Tanakh style. But we do know that the relationship between Michal and David is never the same. The love, the pristine, the... Michal and David is like this classic love story, back in Perek Yerchet. Three times it says that she loves him. It's the only, I told you at the time, it's the only place in all of Tanakh where it ever describes a woman loving a man. It's the only place in all of Tanakh where it ever says that she loved him. Pronouns, feminine to masculine, is Michal loved David, and it says so three times. It's one of these classic, pristine love stories, but only one-sided. It's not clear that David really ever loved Michal, or ever saw her more than the daughter of the king, and therefore his access into the family of the king.
Yeah.
It's unclear. It's a very tragic story. But whatever it was back in Perek Yerchet and Yutet, here he says, I want my wife back. After she'd been given away to Palti Ben Laish.
How many years was that? How many years later was that?
Well, he's in Hebron for 7 years. So we don't know how long it was before Shaul gave Palti Ben Laish away. But it's at least 7 years because it's a 7-year rebellion from the time of the death of Shaul until David becomes king over all of Israel.
Did she have any children with him?
No. That's clear. That's in the text. They never had any children. That's why Bathsheba, that's why Shlomo is the heir to the throne and not any daughter of Michal. And Michal was the peaceful transition of the Malchus from Shaul to David.
Mm-hmm.
Ended in tragedy. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So Chazal are very bothered by this whole story, as are we. Right? Very, very tragic picture. Part of the picture is how could Shaul have given away Michal to another man if she's married to David?
Mm-hmm.
Right? That just doesn't work that way. And so Chazal come up with all kinds of interesting suggestions, and they're all over the map. All over the map. Take a look, for example, in one of this too technical to get into the details of it. I'll just summarize it very briefly. In source 4, there's a lengthy discussion in the Gemara and Sanhedrin about the legalities and the technical legalities of marriage. And how does marriage ceremonies work? It's a concept called Mekadosh B'Milva, where I can create Kedushin by promising to pay you something. Even if I don't pay you, I promise to pay you. That's called a milva. So Shaul promised to pay David great wealth if he would marry his daughter. That's a promise of a marriage gift, right? Kiddushin. On the other hand, David paid with the mayor Lord Plishtim. So it's a whole discussion as to what was the intent at the time of the marriage. Was it on the promise of wealth, or was it on the kiddushin that he provided? Gets into complicated sugya in Masechet Sanhedrin, but in the end, what the Gemara concludes is that there was a legal loophole to be taken advantage of. Shaul took advantage of it and thought he could navigate away from the marriage because it was never done correctly. But it's a very technical piece, and it builds the entire relationship on this kind of halachic technicality. If you take a look at source 5, Source 5, there's two sources, 4 and 5, both in the Gemara and Sanhedrin, literally 2 lines apart. The first opinion is this very technical piece that I just described to you. And the second opinion is the opinion of Rabbi Yossi, who says, Ma kiddushei Michal lepalti ba'avera, af kiddushei merav la'adriel ba'avera, merav's not an issue for now, who says, I don't buy all this technical stuff. I don't buy the technical stuff. In the end, did Shaul have the right to marry Michal to Palti Ben Laish? No. And therefore the marriage was illegal. Did he do it anyway? Sure. Why? Because he's the king. And the king can do what he wants. But he was absolutely had no legal standing, according to the second opinion, to do so. So Machloket, in the Gemara and Sanhedrin, did he have legal standing to be able to give his daughter to Palti Ben Laish or not? Okay? To go one step further, take a look at source 6, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but just kind of the one line that's in bold. it's a medrash, Tana de Be Eliyahu, Rabba lists all of the sins of Shaul. Hmm. We've been studying Shaul since, I don't know, 3 years already, 4 years. He's got a lot of problems, Shaul. He has a lot of sins on his record. The most significant being?
Giving Micha.
No, it's not most significant, right? What's the most significant crime, sin that Shaul has committed?
He didn't kill Amalek.
Amalek is probably, in the text, Amalek is the big one.
Killing out the whole city. I think
the city of Nov is a bigger one, but we discussed that at the time. Right, so the two biggest ones are the failure to kill Amalek and the aftermath of David's rebellion, the killing of the entire city of Nov, all of the Kohanim, and the destruction of the Mishkan. That's a big one. So that's already two big ones. So the Mishnah, the Medrash in source 6 lists all of the crimes of Shaul in the middle of the paragraph. Mashalonit Stavala Asot Asa, Harag et Nov, Ira Kohanim, he killed all the Kohanim of the city of Nov, Vizilzel Ba'arayot, and he was careless in the relations between men and women by giving Michal, his daughter, wife of David, to Palti Ben Laish. Zilzel Ba'arayot. And Sha'u Ba'ova Yedanim, and then he conjured up the spirit of Shmuel through a necromancer, which was also forbidden. And he's got a lot on his plate to answer for. But one of the things he has on his plate to answer for, says the Medrash in Tana de Be Eliyahu, is, by what right did he have to give away Michal? Michal was a married woman. You just go boom, 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 just wash it away, marry her off to somebody else. Right? Yeah, what are you going to say?
Force her to commit adultery, basically.
Right, forces her to commit adultery. Now, to her credit, there is, in the same midrashic response, there is a medrash that says that she and Palti Ben Laish never consummated the marriage, they never had a union together, because she always saw herself as married to David. So to preserve the integrity of that marriage, she and Palti had this agreement that despite Shaul's efforts to marry her off, the Medrash says they never touched each other. But that's a Medrash, right? It's not in the text that way.
Isn't there something that if you divorce your wife...
We haven't gotten to divorce yet. That's another opinion. We'll get there in a second.
I don't know about that. But you can remarry your wife, but if there's someone in
between...
Right,
she marries somebody else in between,
then
you can't.
Prohibited.
Correct. But right now we're not dealing with marriage. We're dealing with adultery. We'll get to divorce and marriage in a second. But right now we're dealing with adultery. According to the first two sources that I read, 5 and 6, she's committing adultery.
Yes. Okay.
So adultery is a bigger issue than taking back your divorced and remarried wife.
Okay.
Right. So at the level of adultery, Shaul is guilty, and Michal could be guilty, but the Medrash says Michal and Palti had an agreement that spared their lives and enabled, therefore, Michal eventually to go back to David, albeit in a teary farewell.
And she could have still, she always loved David, and it wouldn't be a reach to say that, what's his name, loved her. You know, he's
right.
Palti, right?
Palti Ben Laish.
Another possibility.
Shaul may have done so with the authority of the king, not the authority of a father, the authority of a king.
Oh.
What does the authority of a king give him? Why is the authority of a king different? Well, if as the king you declare somebody guilty of treason, what happens?
Death penalty.
And somebody who is guilty of a capital offense and tried and convicted of a capital offense is now on death row.
It's considered as if he's dead.
Right. Halachically, if you stand to be executed, you're as if you already executed. There's a whole discussion. Halachically, that's true. Right? If you kill somebody who is... If you commit murder by killing somebody who's on death row, not clear that you're guilty of murder in the sense that it's a capital offense. Okay. That's unclear. But let's leave that open for now. But certainly, in this case, the Gemara... And that's the source number 7. Different opinion altogether. Nachman Breid Rabbi Shmuel Ben Nachmeni Amar... Amar le Shaul, Ki v'chi yesh ishut le David. What, you think David has legal marriage status with Michal? Hello, moed b'machutu. He's guilty of treason. V'chashuv kamet. Somebody's guilty of treason is as if they've already died, because it's a capital offense. V'ki ilu hu met. V'damo mutar. It's as if he's already dead, and you're allowed to kill him. And therefore, ishto mutaret. His wife is allowed to be married. I don't need any legalities here. I just need to wage my magic wand as king and declare David guilty of treason, and boom, his wife can be married.
So there's nothing wrong with that?
No.
Well, except that David wasn't really guilty of treason, but besides that.
Do you need a base din, or can the
king? Not when you're the king. Not when you're the king. You just wave your magic wand and say it. Well, at least not. When you're working in the world of Shaul, right, due process is not high on your agenda when you're chasing David and accusing him of treason. You're not being rational about anything, so why would you be rational about that? So the Medrash actually puts this argument into the mouth of a very interesting individual. The Medrash says that this was the suggested argument given to Shaul by none other than Doeg HaEdomi. Why is that so interesting? Why does that evoke a chuckle?
Because he gave him bad advice all along.
Because he's the one who executes, the one who informed on David. He's the one who executed all the people of Novi Arkonim, right? So if you want to talk about the personification of the Yetzer Hara, or the personification of all the bad and ill advice to Shaul, right? That voice of the negative conscience, the devil in him, right? That devil in him is Doeg HaEdomi. So that devil comes and says, "Oh, why don't you just marry her off to somebody else?" So Shaul says, great idea. Okay, and so you can see from where that is coming. All of these opinions, 1, 2, 3, 4, all of these four different opinions are all summarized in the Radak in source 8. The Radak literally lists the question and then the answers. It says one answer is given in Chazal, another answer in Chazal, another answer in Chazal, 1, 2, 3, 4, and at the end of the fourth paragraph, he writes, V'chol eila hadvarim rechokim miderech hapshat. He says, he's uncomfortable with all four of these interpretations. Why? Because it doesn't say that Shaul had a conversation with Doeg HaEdomi, and it doesn't say that there was a legal conversation about whether or not David was legally married or not legally married, and it doesn't say that Shaul was guilty of causing Michal to commit adultery, because had she committed adultery, she would not have been allowed to remarry David. So you have to invent another line of the Medrash that says that she and Palti never touched each other. Like, you're dealing with one piece of Midrashic addition to the text after another.
Why would the writer leave out this information?
Right. So, again, we have 10 minutes left. What I'll do briefly in 2 minutes is I'll sketch for you two opposing alternative pictures. And then we'll come up with a third. Right, the two opposing alternative pictures, one is the Radak himself, who says in the last paragraph, V'anachon b'einai, ki get natan David le'michal. When David left, when David fled, getting in those days were far less complicated than they are today.
Okay.
Right, today you need a bezdin, you need a sofer, you need an aid, you need an aid, right? In those days, for katav la get sefer kitut, you take a piece of paper and you write down that the marriage is now over, and you hand it to your wife. Done. Okay. So David is fleeing for his life. He's running down the window, climbing down a string outside the window. He never knows. He doesn't know. Michal is covering for him. Shaul is trying to kill him. David never doesn't know if he'll ever see her again. It's the classic case of an aguna. Right, when he's running, you're never going to know if you're going to see him again. It stands to reason, reasonable and rational, that the last thing you would have done was been to said to Michal, listen, I don't know what's going to happen to me. Arayat mutarat l'chol adam, and hands it to her. Right?
Okay.
There's a masoret that we have in the story about, it become relevant in the story about Sheva, that every soldier who went out to war wrote a get al-tnai to his wife. It's Masoret that we have in the story that it resolves one of the big issues in the story of Bathsheba, which we'll come to. If that's true, then it certainly stands to reason that David would have done so before himself leaving to go to battle or to go out and to escape in the middle of the night, not knowing when you're ever going to come back. And that would resolve one of those issues. It doesn't resolve the issue of Machzir Gushato, but okay. I'm not so bothered by, I'm much more bothered by the adultery piece of it than I am by the case of returning your somebody you divorced and remarried, because there are other ways to resolve that technicality, and it's six chapters away, so not so bothered. I think the get is a reasonable understanding of the story. It's not in the text, but it also doesn't need to be in the text, because it's just a natural action that somebody would take in the case where they were running away, fleeing for their lives. They don't know when they're ever going to come back, if they're ever going to come back.
And they care for the other person.
Right. Right. There's another possibility, which is a little wild, but hey, it's, you know, it works. And that is a theory put forward by Rav Meidan, that David and Michal were never married. They were betrothed.
Okay.
And he bases it on a very interesting verse, which is the verse I showed you in Perek Gimel, when David asks for Michal back. He says, give me my wife, okay, meaning the one to be who was supposed to be my wife, Asher erasti li b'mea orlot plishtim, whom I betrothed with 100 orlot plishtim. So did he marry her or did he betroth her? I can read it both ways, but it's possible to read that their status before David had to flee was of the status of a betrothed, not of marriage. Maybe in which case,
also explains why they never had children.
Right. Although they weren't married long enough to have children, right? The marriage.
What would be the word if you would say married? Is it the same word?
No, marriage would be erastichli li'olam. Erison is betrothal. Marriage is either lakachti, right? Vati lakach lo li'isha. Lakachti li is usually the likichas is marriage, and erison is.
But he's saying that. But he says that he. He had paid for her, with
great mesirut nefesh, by the way, right? With great self-sacrifice, with he put his life on the line when he went out to the marketplace to kill 100 plishtim in order to marry Michal. It wasn't just a sobering, you know, kind of a won a bet in the marketplace. This was a major battle.
So that would say that they were already. That would tell me they were already married.
No. That was the Arison. Marriage, they have to live together as husband and wife. But they didn't have that chance because David had to flee. Right? So that's another way of looking at the story. But I want to come back to the message of the Perek and really sort of pull this all together. Where is Perek of Hay leading me? Where is the end of this chapter leading me? I'm whatever the technical resolution of the Palti Ben Lahish story is, and there are, you can pick, take your pick. You can say Shaul was wrong, Palti was wrong, David was wrong, David was right. You can work through the legalities however you wish. There's multiple options. There's five different options on this page alone. But in the end, none of them are the subject of this chapter. This chapter isn't about the legal framework of Shaul. Did he have the right or not have the right to marry Michal to Palti? It's a fact. Why is it a relevant fact here, now, at this juncture in the Sefer? That's the question. Why is this the question of why is this the issue with which this chapter ends? Is that my question? Mm-hmm. The Perek ends with the marriage of David and Avigail. And then I have two verses that are kind of just out of the blue. Oh, by the way, he also married Achinoam Israelite. And if we're already talking about the wives of David, as you should be aware, Shaul had given Michal away to Palti Ben Lahish.
A reminder about what's going on with the. Mm-hmm. He's still at war. He's still running from or dealing with.
We know he's running from Shaul. What?
Yeah, crazy idea. But for Michal, you know, well, if you married Michal, then maybe there wouldn't be any other wives. She'd be the sole.
Who, Abigail?
There wouldn't be an Abigail.
If he was still married. He can marry Abigail because Michal had been given away?
No, because if Michal still was his wife, then maybe he would not have, you know, had other wives.
Had Michal gone with him?
Had Michal gone with him.
Oh, had Michal gone with him...
We'd write a different ending.
Right. I think that's true. I think that's very true. Michal did not go with him.
No, she didn't.
So therefore, the David's life takes on a
bit
of a...
But he still could have had multiple wives.
Correct.
But
so you're saying it's a positive depiction of...
He would have...
Or a negative depiction?
I think he would have been loyal to Michal and never have needed to marry another woman. That's...
So you're saying
I'm not sure what that proves, but...
Okay. It's a possibility.
History was altered.
I'm just fascinated by the fact that it's relevant here. Right? In other words, I think your point is well taken, right? That the marriage to Abigail needs to be seen against the backdrop of the fact that, hey, what happened to Michal? Well, Michal's not here anymore. Had she been along for the ride,
history
might have been different. Michal's not here anymore. I would only add to that one little nuance, and that is why Achinoam is interjected in the middle. In other words, it's a list of David's wives, is what you have. Abigail, Achinoam, Michal. It's a list of David's wives. Except that the full list of David's wives will come later. At this point, all I have is Abigail and Achinoam, and not Michal. Had all I had was Abigail and Michal, I think you'd be correct, 100%. Had all I had was Abigail and Michal, then the message is David took on Abigail because he no longer had Michal. But why is Achinoam stuck in here? Right? Why is Achinoam here? Why is the marriage Achinoam the last piece of the paragraph? And remember, there's a paragraph break. There's another way to look at it, which is that Michal, the story of Michal is not part of this paragraph. The story of Michal is the introduction to why David is so angry in Parakavav. Parakavav, right, the next parak, is David and Shaul find themselves in the field again. Like that cave story, only this time it has a very different tenor to it, very different feel. David is angry. Shaul is chasing him. Right, we're back to the whole story again, but David's reaction here is much more belligerent. So one of the theories is that because it's introduced to the fact that Shaul gave Michal away, so that it's relevant to the next parak, not relevant to parak at all. But why is Achinoam here? That's relevant. That is part of the parak. That's the last thing in the parak. Is, oh, he marries Abigail. Oh, by the way, also married Achinoam. Michal is another story. So I just leave you with the possibility that there is a very subtle critique of David in this parak. The parak is a pristine story. David, spared the bloodbath, Abigail, whose wisdom and insight and righteousness. It's about David and Abigail from Pasuk Aleph to Pasuk Mem Bet. And he marries Abigail. And they live happily ever after, except for the fact that
he has another wife.
Oh, and he also married Achinoam. Before or after, it doesn't matter. The point is, suddenly this, the pristine message gets diluted. If Abigail is just another one of his kingly entourage, then it's a problem. And if Abigail was his wife instead of Michal, then I could understand. But now I throw in Achinoam and throw in Michal, and we're gonna. Now it's already. It eats away a little bit of the purity with which this parak had come to a conclusion. So. And I think it reflects the human nature of the situation of David. And in the end, David is a tragic figure. David is at a tragic moment in his life. So he has this glorious moment, this very beautiful moment, this very beautiful story. But it's almost like even the moments of beautiful stories in David's life aren't given the ability to be as beautiful and as pure and as perfect as we would like them to be, because the whole situation with David is so tragic. And so kind of hit this jarring note. He marries Avigail. Oh, yeah. He also married Nachinom. Oh, yeah. And he also lost Michal. Oh, yeah. Like, it's a jarring note.
Changes it back to a soap opera.
It's, I don't know, a soap opera, but yeah, it puts us back in the reality of David's world. It's like you're listening to a beautiful piece of music and it ends in a discord. And it just leaves you with that very uncomfortable note at the end, because it ends in a discord. And you're left with that kind of ouch. That's exactly what the parak does. It throws in Achinoam and Michal, and you're left with that discord at the end of the story, and it kind of goes, ouch, it grates on the ear.
Hmm.
Maybe that's the intent.
Hmm.
With that, we have concluded our study of Parak Chaf Hei. It took us, I think, 9 sessions. But we are moving on, Bezrat Hashem, next week to Perek Chaf Vav. New story. Okay.